It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, men in minority groups in Wisconsin face some of the sharpest health, educational, and economic disparities in the country. Organizations around Milwaukee are dedicating this week to tackling those challenges with the Boys and Men of Color Week.
First, there have been a lot of ups and downs for people nearing retirement age in the last decade. The Great Recession has some near retirees pushing their work years further into the future, and it's created uncertainty to this day.
Our next guest has financial advice for people knocking on the door of retirement. Emily Guy Birkin is a finance writer, a contributor to a number of publications. Her new book is called The 5 Years Before You Retire, Retirement Planning When You Need It the Most. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you're not discouraging people from starting to plan even earlier, but why is 5 years a really good, solid starting point?
Well, that is the point at which people suddenly realize, oh my goodness, this is real. Every single one of us tend to be procrastinators. And so, you know, you're focused on other things through much of your career, you know, raising your family, saving for college, those sorts of things. And it's within those 5 years before retirement that all of a sudden it becomes real and you realize, oh, I really need to focus on this. And 5 years is a good chunk of time in that there is still time for you to make a major difference in your retirement, but it's not so much time that you go, oh, I don't have to worry about that till later.
And you wrote a piece, I think it was earlier this year, on how our brains can sometimes keep us from planning for retirement even once we get into that window. How can we overcome our brain's reluctance to tackle these issues?
Well, it's all about outwitting yourself, actually. If you make plans that are going to thwart your laziest self, that's the important thing to do. For instance, one of the things that that people tend to do is they always think, oh, later I'm going to fund my retirement. So what you can do is right now, because, you know, when you're thinking about it right now, go ahead and plan to have every single raise that you get over the next few years just automatically put into your retirement account. And so then you don't have to think about it later. And a lot of companies are allowing you to have an automatic increase in your 401k savings and things like that that you do once a year. And if you think about that before the raise is on the table, before you start thinking, yes, well, but I could do this with the money or I could do that with the money, when you are just clearly thinking, no, I want to make sure that I have a secure retirement and you're not at the moment tempted by the money in your pocket, then you're much more likely to save than if you wait until you get the raise and you start having that lifestyle creep.
Now, once we're in that 5-year-ish window, how do we start assessing our retirement readiness?
Well, the important thing to do is just peel off the bandage real quickly. A lot of people are afraid to look at what their retirement accounts have. And so I liken really starting to plan for retirement as very similar to starting a weight loss regimen. The very first thing you have to do is get on the scale and know where you are. And that actually can be the biggest stumbling block for most people because they know they haven't done enough, and so they're afraid to look at how bad it is, and so they just hide their head in the sands. So the very first thing you need to do is just take a clear look at where you are. Find all of your retirement accounts. If you haven't started one, find the information that you need to do that, and start looking at those calculators for how much you will need for a comfortable retirement. It can be very uncomfortable and difficult to do this particular thing. And again, like it's actually in some ways the easiest part. You know, just like stepping on the scale is the easiest part of losing weight. But psychologically, it hurts. So just go ahead and do that. And then same thing, no shame, no blame about what's gone on in the past. Just plan on moving forward. Because if you start like, well, I should have done this and I should have done that, that's not doing what you need to do, which is planning ahead.
So suppose we've hit that 5-year mark, we haven't set much aside. What kind of changes can we make in that short 5-year span that are really going to make a difference and allow us to retire and be okay when we do that?
Well, there's a couple of things that I would recommend people do. The first one is generally people who are 5 years to retirement, they have already hit the age where they can maximize their retirement accounts. For instance, for a 401k, the maximum that you can you can contribute before you reach, I believe it's age 55, is $17,500. After age 55, it's $23,000. So take advantage of those maximums. So that's one thing that you can do. Now, I know a lot of people will listen to that and be like, I can't put that much money aside. Well, the other thing to do is plan long-term, even if you only have 5 years before your projected retirement date. And the way that you can do that is by using something called the bucket method, or it's also called strategic asset allocation, where basically you plan on having three different sets of money. One set is for short term, and you're going to put money in there that you want to protect the principal. So it's going to be low volatility, things like treasury bills, CDs, and things like that. And so that's the stuff that you want to know is there for the first, let's say, 5 years of retirement. Then you'll have a second bucket that's going to have a little higher volatility. It's going to have more bonds, some stocks, 4 years, like 6 through 15. And then you'll have a third bucket for years 16 through the end of your life. And so by having those things, you have the time to allow your assets to grow for that last bucket, even if you haven't saved that much between now and up until this point, and even if you only have about 5 years to go. You can stretch your money, make it grow a little bit longer by doing this, rather than focusing on, I have to have whatever $0.1 million that you want to have.
Now, we've talked a little bit about figuring out what money we have. I know in the book you get into checking out our income and our expenses, but say we do that, the income is clearly going to be less than our monthly expenses. How do we start adjusting our lifestyle, our expectations, our mindsets to be ready to balance the books after we retire?
Well, I think that it's really important to remember that, you know, There are two ways to think about retirement. There's your dream retirement, and it's a great idea to dream big. You know, think big and what you really, really would love to have if money were no object. So that's one side of it. And then on the other side of the coin, I want you to think little, which is what's the least you need to feel good, to have a contented retirement. So the story that I tell is there was an older woman who, she and her husband had lost everything. And so she was a widow by the time that I knew her and was living in basically a group home. And it was not an ideal retirement. But she was an avid reader. In this group home, they took her to the library regularly, so she got all the books that she wanted. She had a safe place to stay. She had three square meals a day. She had people that she could talk to, and she was perfectly happy. That's not the retirement she ever would have dreamed of, but it was the minimum she needed to feel content. So recognizing that somewhere in between that big dream retirement and that minimum contented retirement is going to be where you're living. So if you know what those are, you can start cutting the expenses that you don't really need to be contented. And that's actually a really important exercise to do no matter where you are in your life or your career, but just recognizing that there you don't need nearly as much as you might think you do.
Now, at the end of your book, you list some common pitfalls in retirement planning. Among them, as we're factoring our costs, not accounting for health care. How can we make sure we've taken that into consideration?
Well, healthcare is a really scary thing because the current estimates for healthcare is $220,000 for healthcare costs in retirement for a 65-year-old couple who retired in 2013. So, and 65-year-olds, they are eligible for Medicare, so that is still factoring Medicare in. There's a common misconception that Medicare takes care of everything healthcare-wise when you retire. So the main thing to do is to spend some time actually looking at the numbers and figuring out what you can expect healthcare-wise financially. And that includes, you know, factoring in your own health and knowing, you know, your family health issues and things like that. So it's, again, it's not the most pleasant way to plan for retirement, but it's something you absolutely need to do to know what to expect if you are to get sick or, in particular, if you're to need long-term care, which is if you need regular help with any kind of, daily living, you know, eating, bathing, cooking, that sort of thing, but don't actually need to be in a nursing home necessarily or in a hospital, because that is something that Medicare doesn't cover and can just eat up an estate.
Emily, as we wrap up, can you convince us on Halloween that we shouldn't be living in fear of retirement? Can you boost our morale a little?
Absolutely. You know, you need less than you think you do for retirement. Now, I need to be careful saying that because so many people don't actually save. Over a third of baby boomers have less than $10,000 saved, and almost half, 46% of the general population has less than $10,000 saved for retirement. However, if you are planning for retirement, if you're putting money aside, you're already ahead of the curve. So the people who are listening to this and who are freaking out because, oh, I haven't saved enough, if you've already thought about it, you're ahead of the curve. The other thing is people get very concerned about Social Security, and Social Security is not perfect. There are certainly some problems with it, but it is there. It is something that can help to supplement your income. So don't forget that that's an option. Also, if you are married or have been married, so spousal Social Security can actually make a big difference and can very much help. And there's, in fact, I believe it's something like 83 different ways you can take Social Security in conjunction with a spouse or even an ex-spouse. So really, retirement doesn't need to be frightening. The other thing to remember is that our view of retirement is the end of work, and that's actually not a good view. When you end work, a lot of people die just a couple of years after they just finish their career and, you know, make boats in bottles afterwards, because we're meant to work. So if you think of retirement as a new chapter in your life, as a change in how you live, as a change in your career, then it's going to infuse much more life in your life. And it's also going to make it possible for you to extend your savings much farther. So all of these are very positive things and very good ways to look at retirement without being super frightened of it.
Emily, thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That's finance writer Emily Guy Burkin. Her new book is The 5 Years Before You Retire, Retirement Planning When You Need It the Most. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Men in minority groups in Wisconsin face some of the sharpest disparities in things like education, health, employment in the country. Last month, President Obama called on communities around the U.S. to take the My Brother's Keeper Challenge, geared at helping disadvantaged boys through school and into a career.
Milwaukee has responded to that challenge with the nation's first ever Boys and Men of Color Week. It began last Saturday and it ends tomorrow. And it's been aimed at getting organizations from throughout the community to talk and coordinate their community building efforts.
The week has included events like a day of prayer, healing and fellowship, as well as conversations about youth organizing, violence prevention, and a fatherhood summit.
Lead organizer Jeffrey Roman joins us now. He's the benchmark coordinator for the Minority Male Achievement at the Community Advocates Public Policy Institute. Jeffrey, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Thanks for having me, Veronica. Happy to be here.
Well, what was the motivation for Milwaukee's Boys and Men of Color Week? How did it get started?
The motivation really was propelled by the White House's advancement of the My Brother's Keeper initiative, which is really the latest addition to a national movement that started about 8 years ago around improving outcomes for boys and men of color, with a particular focus on African-American males. And so here in Milwaukee, we've been doing this work and working to organize and coordinate efforts for a number of years now, but really didn't get the impetus to really take it to the next level until the My Brother's Keeper initiative was launched back in February of this year.
So that in mind, what were your goals going into this week?
So our goals going into this week was really about changing the narrative. For every one negative thing that we hear about a young man of color, there are 10 or 15, 20 positive stories that we don't hear in our community. So goal number one was about lifting up the resiliency and the great and positive things that young men of color are doing here in Milwaukee, in the southeast region of the state, and across the state, to change the narrative and to show that there are positive young men here in Milwaukee.
Well, let's go with that for a little bit. Resiliency and positive narratives. Can you tell us a few? What do you want people who may be listening and don't have that resiliency yet? What do you want them to know about the power that they have?
I want them to know that you are in control of your own destiny. And if you are committed to doing what you have to do to be strong, to be self-determined, you can do whatever it is that you want to do in this city, in this state, in this country, and that it's up to you, provided you have the support and the resources necessary to do that. Mentors, You have a pathway to quality education. You have a pathway to an internship or a service or a public ally internship. You can do anything that you want to do, provided you have the support and the resources you need to do it.
Now, why do you feel that it is men and boys that needed to be focused on right now in this week?
Really because of the opportunity that the White House and the national movement has given to us. I started this work at about 12 years ago. I started doing teen pregnancy prevention work and saw that we were having a conversation that was one-sided. We were talking about the things that young ladies needed and young girls needed to keep themselves from becoming pregnant, but we didn't talk about the other side of the equation, which was that they're young men and the role that they play in teen pregnancy. And so for me, it was a personal thing. How do we level the playing field and make sure that we're adequately responding to the needs of young men and teen pregnancy in this work? And it grew from there. And it grew into, you know, how are we looking at the educational disparities and looking at violence? And we always have these one-sided conversations. So this week was really about leveling the conversation and making sure that we're focusing on the other side of the equation.
Do you think that men and minority communities can get overlooked?
I think so, because of the negative messages that we have out there for young men of color in Milwaukee specifically. We tend to focus on the negative, those negative things versus looking at the positivity and the positive things that are happening with young men.
Can you talk a little bit about why this may have been particularly important to do in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, and what challenges that might be specific to men living in Milwaukee?
Sure. So we know that for the state of Wisconsin, we have the highest incarceration rates in the nation for African-American men. We know that in Wisconsin, because in Milwaukee, that we have among the lowest high school graduation rates, and it's all happening here, particularly in communities of color. And so we thought it was particularly important to really focus this conversation here in Milwaukee, where the majority of young men of color reside, and where the majority of young men of color work, and where the majority of young men of color have their families and build their communities. And not that it's just singularly focused or exclusive to Milwaukee, but we know that this is where the base is, and we know that this is where the majority of those young people live. And if we can work with them to be able to pull themselves up in this community, we can be an example for other communities, like communities across the region and across the state.
I understand that there are 6 goals or focus areas that you had going into this week. Do you want to talk about what they are and why they're important?
Sure. So the My Brother's Keeper initiative really gave a framework to help cities align and come up with a strategy to be able to improve outcomes for boys and men and all young people in general. And so they're broader goals that focus on all young people, and there are 6 of them. The first is that all children enter school ready to learn, and that they are ready cognitively, physically, socially, and emotionally. The second is that all children can read at grade level by 3rd grade. The third is that all youth graduate from high school, and that they graduate from high school on time. The fourth is that all young people complete or have a pathway to post-secondary education or training, and whether that's a 4-year college degree or a 2-year vocational program or an internship, they have those pathways to post-secondary education and training. The fifth is that all youth who are of working age are employed or have a pathway to employment. And then the last one is that all youth remain safe from violent crime and are provided second chances.
And you had your, as we said, this was your first week. Tomorrow it ends, and it began with a day of healing and prayer. What happened on that day?
So what we did, we wanted to make sure that the week was inclusive of all the communities, of all the sectors that we believe play an important piece to improving outcomes for all young people in Milwaukee, particularly young men. And so the first day of the week on Sunday was a day of prayer, healing, and fellowship. And what we did was we reached out to our faith-based partners, our congregations, our mosques, our synagogues, and we asked them to use their most important tool of empowerment, prayer followed by action, to help set the tone for the week in their respective contexts and their respective religious programming. So that was the start of the week, and then on Monday, we turned to our academic community, and we went to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and we organized and we worked with the faculty and the various departments and schools at UW-Milwaukee to really talk about what is the role of academia in this work? What are we doing about evaluation, and what are we doing about data collection, and how are we evaluating the work and measuring the impact that we have? And then on Tuesday, we opened it up to the entire community via social media. And so we were on Twitter and on Facebook and in other outlets talking about and engaging the community about what are some ideas, how do we shape a cooperative vision for Milwaukee, what are things that need to happen, and what are your experiences, what are your stories, how can we inform this work moving forward.
And we'll pick up on the rest of that when we come back. We're speaking right now with Jeffrey Roman. He's the lead organizer of Milwaukee's Boys and Men of Color Week. The event began last Saturday and it ends tomorrow. It's geared toward tackling challenges facing Milwaukee's minority men in areas of education, health, employment, and more.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with serious racial disparities in Wisconsin. Do you see them? How does this play out in your community? What kind of action is your community taking to deal with them? What would you like to see done that isn't being done? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about Milwaukee's Boys and Men of Color Week with Maine organizer Jeffrey Roman. The initiative began last Sunday and it ends tomorrow. It's geared toward tackling the disparities minority men in Milwaukee face in areas like education, health, and employment. And it's also a response to President Obama's My Brother's Keeper Challenge issued last month.
And you can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Wisconsin has some of the biggest racial disparities in a number of categories in the whole country. How do you see those playing out around you? And do you have solutions? What do you think might help close those gaps? What's going on in your community, in your life? And did you participate in the events this week? What did you come away with? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, we were talking earlier about the high incarceration rates in Milwaukee for African American males, and one of the problems that you see there is what you call the prison pipeline. Can you talk about that and how that might play out and how you'd like to reverse it?
Sure. So we know that young men of color, particularly in the education, the early education system, for various reasons, are put on a trajectory to the criminal justice system. There are touch points, even within the school systems, that are early touch points to the law enforcement, early touch points to the criminal justice system that happens in the school system. And so one of the things that we're working with our school district and with the educational systems is, how do we start to change the cultures of our schools to identify and become culturally responsive to the needs and to the varying cultural dynamics and cultural nuances that young people of color face within the school systems, to prevent and to challenge our schools to be able to prevent that pipeline to law enforcement within the school system.
Is that one of those narratives that you think needs to be challenged, that young African-American men see what you call the prison pipeline and it becomes something that feels like it would take a lot of work not to be part of that they need to move in a different direction, and you're trying to get different options and different narratives on the table?
Yeah, it's really about exposing young people to the resources and to the pipelines to other options, whether that's career, college, whether that's service, whether that's looking at ways to be entrepreneurs or being innovative. It's really about the exposure, exposing them to mentors at an earlier age, making sure that that resources and services are wrapped around young people of all ages, of all colors, so that they don't have to look for alternatives in the underground market or in the negative things that far too often in communities of color or in urban central communities are at the surface. So it's about exposing them to those positive things.
One thing that's going into this effort is to get all kinds of organizations with similar interests to talk together, to work together. Do you have some examples of how that happened this past week?
Yeah. So the very reason that we had Boys and Men of Color Week was to demonstrate that we can coordinate and collaborate. And so there were a number of organizations who were looking at and following the lead of President Obama and the lead of the national movement around Boys and Men of Color, who wanted to, you know, say that we play a part in this and we want to do our part to be able to make sure that all young people in our community are successful and are advancing equal to everybody else. And so it was the willingness of, you know, for example, the nonprofit Center of Greater Milwaukee and some of our funders, United Way and the Berg Foundation, who were having similar conversations in their spheres of influence that connected with other organizations, that connected with our faith partners, that connected with our academic partners and said, we're all talking about the same thing. It doesn't make sense to do it in our own silos. So let's demonstrate a way to coordinate and collaborate. And that's what we did this week. That was the impetus behind Boys and Men of Color Week, was to demonstrate authentic collaboration here in Milwaukee, because we're willing and we're able to do it.
Were there conversations happening that never would have happened without this week?
I think what we did this week, what we accomplished this week, was we set a table for those who were having the conversation to start to have them together. And so there were many, there's a lot of conversation happening around education. There's a lot of education happening around health, around access to health. There's a lot of education or a conversation talking about access to employment and opportunities, but they're happening in parallel to one another. And so what this week did was to start to set the table so that those who are working on those varying things, focus on young men and focus on communities and focusing on families, could all start to begin to talk about those things together.
One of the events during the week was called a Day of Dialogue. And I wonder if you could talk about what was said, what came up during that day.
Well, a lot of the things that we saw throughout the week actually was, this is something new for us here. We always talk in our own circles. We always talk in our own silos, but we've never had an opportunity, or we rarely have an opportunity, what I call the convergence of interests, where we can come together and really talk about the good things that we're doing here in Milwaukee, where we can talk about the great resources and the great work that's happening in Milwaukee. We never get an opportunity to pat ourselves on the back. And I'm really excited and really happy that we were able to do that this week. We were able to highlight those that are doing, the individuals and organizations that are doing the great work on the ground, the policymakers and the academic people and our faith leaders who are really out in the trenches working to be able to improve outcomes. And we set the stage for that and highlighted the positivity happening in Milwaukee.
If you've got any on the, you know, the tip of your brain, as it were, right now, do you have any of those positive pat yourself on the back stories that came out of this week?
Well, there are a number of them. I think this week alone is one of those stories. But I do want to lift up one of the individuals, one of the people that we was sort of behind that. The reason of doing that, there was an individual, Andre Lee Ellis, here in Milwaukee, an older gentleman who decided that he wasn't going to wait on anybody to come to his neighborhood to help redirect the young men and the young people in his neighborhood. And so he decided on his own to organize his community, started to do work, to develop a garden in his community, and invited young people to work with him. And every week throughout this summer, this past summer, more people from the community joined him at his community garden and started to change the things and the dynamics in their community just by engaging them and talking to the young people in those neighborhoods. Those are the type of things that we wanted to lift up, that there are pockets of resilience and pockets of success and people in our community that often aren't recognized for the great things that they're doing. And this is an opportunity to be able to lift that up.
Now, another one of the events I want to talk about is the Fatherhood Summit.
Yes.
I wonder if you could talk about what kinds of issues came up and what you're tackling there.
So the Milwaukee Fatherhood Summit this year, it's its ninth annual summit that was led by the Milwaukee Fatherhood Initiative. And again, it's about the role in empowering fathers in our community to be stronger fathers and stronger mentors and stronger providers in the lives of their children. So it's all about resourcing fathers and older men. How do we look through our own challenges and work through our own challenges so that we can be present and involved in the lives of our children? How do we start to repair the relationships that we have with our significant others for the benefit of our children? How do we start to work together as a community for the benefit of our children? And the Fatherhood Summit is all about building that up and looking to our men and our fathers and having them recognize and understand that they have a role to play and that our communities are only as strong as our fathers, are only as strong as our families, and are only as strong as our communities working together.
Now, you had all of these organizations coming together, all of this positivity and empowerment happening this past week. It ends tomorrow. What's the roadmap going forward?
Well, the roadmap going forward is, you know, based off what we've started this week, let's continue the conversation. Let's continue the collaborative spirit of having a conversation about the great things that are happening here, while acknowledging some of the barriers and biases structurally that we have to face to be able to overcome some of the barriers that impede progress for young men of color. And so I'm excited that about the conversation moving forward, and that a lot of people, the feedback that we've been getting is that a lot of people are motivated and were inspired this week and authentically want to continue the conversation and identify the role and want to commit to be able to move this forward.
Now, it all ends tomorrow, as we said, this first week that you have tried here. What happens tomorrow? What's the big grand finale?
So the grand finale actually it's been a grand week already, but the finale tomorrow is the end of the Milwaukee Fatherhood Summit. They wrap up the week. We've had a long week of great things going on, but it wraps up tomorrow with the Milwaukee Fatherhood Summit, the second day. And it's really about, you know, coming together as a community, understanding the roles that we all play and supporting each other. But the conversation won't end tomorrow. The work doesn't end tomorrow. We just wanted to set the table this week. And you can look forward for a lot of things coming out of our Boys and Men of Color initiative here in Milwaukee.
Any final message you want to leave with people who hear you and might want to get involved for next year or down the road?
I just want to leave with you our contact information. You can reach us at www.bmocmilwaukee.org, or you can hashtag and Twitter us at BMOCMKE, and help us realize our vision. And that is a vision where all young men of color and all young people in Milwaukee are healthy, productive, and empowered to live their lives to their fullest potential. That's what we're reaching. That's what we're reaching to do, and that's what we're committing to do.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Jeffrey Roman, the lead organizer, of Milwaukee's Boys and Men of Color Week. It began last Sunday and it ends tomorrow, and focuses on tackling disparities facing Milwaukee's boys and men.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
It's time for our state news roundup with WPR's assistant news director. He joins us every week at this time.
Today, in the lead up to Election Day, we look at the results from the latest and last Marquette poll before the election. And some news also about the frac sand issues facing the state. Noah Ovshinsky joins us now. Hey, Noah, thanks for coming back.
It is very good to be here, and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you as well. So the Marquette poll, the last one before the election, came out. What did it show us?
So this latest poll, the last one before the election, has Governor Walker up by 7 percentage points among likely voters. That's 50% compared to Mary Burke's 43%. That's outside the margin of error, and it also represents a change from the last poll in which she and Mary Burke were, you know, essentially neck and neck.
Now, we're looking here at likely voters. What about registered voters?
So, yeah, that's the other group that we pay attention to in these polls. And when you look at this group of voters, the poll had the two much closer. According to the poll, Governor Walker has a 1-point lead, 46% to 45% among registered voters.
Okay, break that down for us. What does it mean?
Experts will say that, you know, this doesn't mean people's opinions are, you know, necessarily changing, you know, in a week's period in any sort of dramatic way, at least, because as I just said, when you look at the registered voter numbers, you know, they haven't changed much. It's an indication, actually, that, you know, Republicans are probably much more likely to show up on Election Day. The Marquette poll identifies likely voters as those who say they will definitely vote. It doesn't count people who say, you know, they will probably vote. So when you look at the difference between likely voters and registered voters, you know, that tells you that there's definitely likely going to be a difference in turnout, and that that may be a deciding factor.
And another thing we're looking at here and trying to factor in is independents. What do we know there?
Yeah, so Governor Walker had made gains in this group in the last few weeks. According to this latest poll, he leads Mary Burke 52% to 37%. That was just a few short weeks ago. They were tied. So Governor Walker has made really some pretty significant inroads with independent voters. And I would say that probably bodes well for him going into next week's election.
And as we look at what this could mean for the campaigns themselves, what's the takeaway here?
So obviously winning over those independents is going to be important, but probably more important is going to be turnout.
It's always turnout, isn't it? Is it ever not turnout?
Well, I mean, I guess at the end of the day, any election is really about, you know, how many people turns out for any particular voter. But I mean, in this election, it really does have to do with turnout, only because the dynamics between midterm elections and those elections that involve a presidential race vary so much when it comes to turnout.
And a midterm election, fewer people vote in midterm. So I guess turnout, we're doubling down on the turnout now.
Fewer Democrats vote in midterm elections versus elections with presidential candidates in them.
And we'll get more to that coming up. But so in terms of this candidate now and these campaigns, what's going on there? What do they need to do?
So for Mary Burke, it means getting out as much as she can in front of her base, especially in Milwaukee. She needs as many people in Milwaukee, as many Democrats, to come out as possible to vote for her on Thursday. And if you need any evidence, all you have to do is look at all the big Democrats who have visited Milwaukee in the last few weeks. I mean, these are heavy hitters in the Democratic Party. We're talking about Michelle Obama, President Obama, and Bill Clinton. All three of them have come to Milwaukee in recent weeks to stump for her. And that entire, strategy is geared towards getting as many people in Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee, the county of Milwaukee, to come out next week.
Okay, so we have Mary Burke zooming in on Milwaukee for Governor Walker. What's ahead for him?
Yeah, for Governor Walker, these numbers mean that, he needs to make sure that the ground game his ground game is in order. And he needs, obviously, his base in the suburbs of Milwaukee and points north to show up on November 4th. As we said, Walker already has an advantage going into this election when it comes to turnout. I think really for the Democrats, the pressure is on them to show up next week.
And in terms of this last week, and now it's not even a week, it's days that we're talking about here. What have these candidates been up to?
Oh, they've been traveling, doing a lot of traveling. And, Governor Walker spent a lot of time, around Eau Claire and that area. That is an area where I wouldn't necessarily say it's purple, but it's an area that there are both Democrats and Republicans in the Eau Claire area and Chippewa Valley. That's an area that I think is certainly important for both candidates. So they're spending a lot of time there. La Crosse, Susan Happ, the candidate for Attorney General, was up in Superior today. So she's looking to get some votes up in the Superior area in the Northwoods. So they're all hitting up those places. Green Bay, another great example. Fox Valley. These are all areas that have large numbers of voters. And both candidates need to get as many of them as possible.
And another race we've been talking a lot about over these past weeks is the attorney general's race. And one of the themes that keeps coming back is, do voters know who these candidates are enough to vote? And name recognition, face recognition, stance on policies. Has that shifted? Do voters know who they are at this point?
When you compare it to the governor's race, there are still a lot of people who don't know enough really about Brad Schimmel or Susan Happ to have an opinion, frankly, and that hasn't really changed dramatically over the last few weeks. According to the latest poll among likely voters, 14% are still undecided. As far as who's leading, according to the poll, Brad Schimmel leads Happ 43-39%. If you factor in the margin of error, the numbers still show it to be a very close race.
Okay, so when you factor in that these candidates may not have the best name recognition among voters, what does that mean come Election Day?
Yes. Well, if history is any indication, people, if they don't know a lot about a candidate, will vote according to party. And then again, not that I want to sound like a broken record, but I'm going to say it again, that means turnout is going to be key. Just like in the governor's race, turnout is going to be key for both Brad Schimmel and Susan Happ going into this election.
Okay, well, we'll be watching that one along with lots of other races. Today is, Noah, the last day of early voting. Do we know right now how many people have voted so far?
Right. So as of just around noon, about 240,300 absentee ballots have been cast in this election. If you break it down, if you want to get into the numbers even more, 173,000 of those were cast in a clerk's office, and just under 67,000 were sent in by mail. These are preliminary numbers, but they do give us a sense of what participation is looking like.
And historically speaking, how does that compare?
Those numbers, at least when you compare them to the 2012 recall election, the last election, those numbers exceed the recall election.
And has the Government Accountability Board said what they're expecting turnout to be? Can they project at this point?
Yes, the all-important turnout. According to the GAB, about 2.5 million people are expected to cast ballots. And that's about 56.5% of Wisconsin's 2014 voting age population. So again, just over 50% are expected to vote.
And of course, the last elections we've been through here in Wisconsin have been the recall elections. How does this election season seem to be comparing to that?
Yeah, so the GAB says turnout will be similar to the 2012 recall election, which came in at 57.8%. That is still less than what we would expect in a presidential year, what we talked about a few minutes ago. And in presidential years, turnout, hovers somewhere around 70%. So turnout is looking to be, similar to the recall election of 2012.
And a referendum we have on the ballot as well this year. Tell us about that.
Right. So this is another big issue, actually, that just people have been paying attention to. Candidates are not the only thing on the ballot. Voters statewide will be asked whether they want the Constitution to be amended in such a way that prevents money from being taken out of the transportation fund to pay for other things that are, totally unrelated to infrastructure repair.
And Governor Walker, what does he say about that?
So he backs this amendment. And in fact, part of that is because he's criticized former Governor Doyle for using transportation funds, around $1 billion or so, to pay for schools and health care. And what Governor Walker and others, and certainly in the road building industry and other politicians would like to do is they'd like to insulate that fund, that transportation fund, and allow only the taxes that are raised, from cars, planes, railroads. They only want that money to be spent on infrastructure.
And what about people who say, no, this should be used, where it's needed? What do they say?
Right. So critics say governors, like Governor Dole, Governor Doyle, critics say governors should have the flexibility to be able to use that money for other purposes, especially when there is an economic downturn. That money shouldn't necessarily be sacred. It should be used where the legislature and the governor thinks it should be spent.
And as we wrap up, Noah, there's one last story we want to take a quick look at, a frac sand petition going on.
Yeah, so a group of Western Wisconsin residents and an environmental group submitted a petition to the Natural Resources Board this week, asking it to direct the DNR to study the frac sand industry.
And what has been the response from the board so far?
So the DNR board chairman, Preston Cole, actually has directed the DNR to review this citizen's petition and report back to the board with its recommendations.
And in terms of the residents, what are they hoping for exactly from the DNR?
They want the DNR to really do a comprehensive analysis of how this industry is affecting water, land, air, and just basically the quality of life for those residents who live near frac sand installations. According to the group Midwest Environmental Advocates, who's basically behind this petition, the DNR hasn't really taken a close enough look at this industry since it essentially blew up about 3-4 years ago.
And real quickly, what happens next?
The DNR comes back with its recommendations to the board. It's unclear when those recommendations will be made. The next board meeting is in December. It could happen then or next year.
Well, Noah, thanks a lot for stopping by. I appreciate your time.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
Noah Fshinsky is WPR's assistant news director. He joins us every week at this time to talk state news.
I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.